This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
London loses its crown as Europe's stock trading hub. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. Financial services is a key driver of the UK economy, but so-called equivalence rules about how the industry works with its European counterparts was largely left out of the last-minute Brexit deal agreed back in December. Since January, that's meant EU-based financial companies have been barred from trading in London. And that is causing the nearly $200 billion British industry to lose business to other European cities. Officials are working to hammer out an equivalence deal, but in a speech Wednesday night, Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey argued the EU is holding the UK to unrealistically high standards, in part due to worries about whether the UK might choose to loosen financial regulations in order to attract more post-Brexit business.
Now, the EU has argued that it must better understand how the UK intends to amend or alter the rules going forwards. This is a standard that the EU holds no other country to and would, I suspect, not agree to be held to itself. So let me be clear. None of these proposed changes mean that the UK should or will create a low regulation, high risk, anything goes financial centre and system. We have an overwhelming body of evidence that such an approach is not in our own interests, let alone anybody else's.
The back and forth, though, is having a real effect on the UK already. FT journalist Philip Stafford has been digging into the latest trading data and discovered last month Amsterdam took London's long-held status as Europe's largest share trading center with a fourfold increase in January from the number of shares traded in December.
In the short term, it's more symbolic than a significant blow in terms of jobs or lost tax receipts. Share trading itself isn't taxed on the number of shares you do, and it's actually quite a lean and efficient industry when it comes to the number of people actually in it. Most of it is done by computers. So it's not a really person-intensive industry. That said, this was something that London just did. And, you know, I've looked at the numbers pretty regularly for most of the last decade. When I say regularly, I'm talking about once a month at least. And London is always buying the top spot. And that really has changed in just a couple of weeks. The point is, of course, that once you actually establish a new center of trading and everyone sees it somewhere else, then there's always a danger that sooner or later, jobs and money follows money.
Now, the UK and the EU have set this new March deadline to come up with an equivalence policy to make trading and financial services businesses easier between the two places. So if that happens, could London retake its crown?
I think as the reality of life has unfolded and people have got used to living without any, those hopes have really faded. And I think there is a much more a sober assessment of what is likely to come at the end of March. If the UK and EU agree something, it's likely to be a sort of a technical regulatory deal which would allow regulators to decide what they can accept and share with each other. I don't think it's going to go as far as giving any sort of wider market access permissions that in effect allow the trading to come back. You know, if you can understand it from the EU's perspective, they have wanted to have more oversight of what are essentially euro-denominated assets, to have them within their own purview. It's moved. In essence, why would you want to change something that has turned to your advantage? And don't forget that this permit that we're talking about, this isn't a bilaterally negotiated permit. This is a unilateral decision on behalf of the EU can make for itself.
So we heard last week on this program from the boss of Barclays, who said actually he's not too concerned about the impact of Brexit because the UK should be less concerned with competing with Europe and more focused on Asia and the US. What have you been hearing? Do you think that's a refrain that is common in the city, as we call it here, effectively London's Wall Street?
It is fairly common, although something is big as the city isn't ever really going to speak with one voice on anything. But having said that, yes, I think there is a certain feeling that the EU will be the EU market. You'll need access to it. But there are other opportunities, especially in the bigger end of the market, where there's a lot of investment banks and then their biggest customers, whether it be huge big corporations or hedge funds, pension funds, asset managers, they will play and tend to look much more globally. That said, nobody ever wants to cut off from a market and face additional costs to enter a market. And that's sort of what is happening when it comes to dealing with the EU. A lot of people are just finding the only way to actually ensure that you're going to have access to the EU market is to base people and a headquarters specifically within the bloc.
The FT's Philip Stafford, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Checking the numbers now, global benchmarks are a little changed this morning. Shares of Royal Dutch Shell are down 2%. In its latest strategy update today, the Anglo-Dutch oil giant gave an update on its plans to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. It's not the only energy giant to continue shifting away from oil and gas. Most major European energy companies have similar targets. But amid that change, a new report says oil and gas producing countries face trillions of dollars in losses over the next two decades if the world does indeed meet internationally agreed targets to limit global warming. The BBC's Andrew Walker has that story.
Carbon Tracker describes its report as a wake-up call. It says that containing global warming would reduce total government revenue up to 2040 for some countries, including Saudi Arabia, Nigeria and Iraq, by between 20 and 40%. For some, including Angola and Azerbaijan, the predicted loss is even larger. The report calls for the rest of the world to help 40 highly oil and gas dependent countries to diversify their economies. It says there's a moral case for it, as some of them are very poor.
Andrew Walker reporting there. We've talked a lot here about the supply and demand equation surrounding the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. This week, a review in the Lancet Medical Journal said Russia's Sputnik V candidate appears safe and effective, despite early criticism for lack of transparency in the development process. Professor Ian Jones at the University of Reading co-wrote that review, told me whether high public confidence in Russia's vaccine could alleviate some of the supply pressures around the world.
Formally, what they've done is really no different from the developments of the AstraZeneca vaccine or the Johnson & Johnson vaccines. They've used these so-called adenovirus vectors, which are very similar to those that are being used elsewhere. You might consider that all of these manufacturers are basically knocking out the same car with a different paint job. And so long as the production of the vector has been carried out properly, and so long as the phase 3 trial data is complete, there is no reason that one of them should perform any differently from any of the others.
I don't know if there's a way to quantify how much, I guess, strain this vaccine and the confidence around it could alleviate some of the pressure around the world. And I think some of the Russia's partners may be involved in potentially places that wouldn't be first in line for Pfizer or AstraZeneca's vaccine. So does it sort of alleviate the pressure in that way?
Yes, it does. I mean, if you're talking about, is this additional proof of a valid vaccine useful in a global setting, then absolutely the answer is yes, because it will now get to people who otherwise would not be able to get a vaccine. Certainly, it's another valid source of vaccine for the world.
So when it comes to the supply part of the equation, then, we've seen for the last several weeks the EU and AstraZeneca, in a dispute about how quickly the bloc will get their vaccines. Adding one more seems like it would alleviate this problem around the world. How quickly do you think production can be ramped up, and how easy is it to do that?
It's straightforward, but not easy. The one drawback of these adenovirus vectors is that the dose that is used for the vaccine is as good as you can ever manufacture. You're not in a situation where you can easily make 10 times as much and then dilute it. It's really flat out manufacturing. Coming to the alleviation of current log jams, Russia will have its own bilateral agreements with the Middle East and with South American countries. And so it may be the case that they can provide those collaborators with the materials that they've made, but that there will not be very much spare to alleviate the current lack of material in Europe. Overall, there are still many more people who need the vaccine than the current supply can meet, I think.
Could part of the solution, I guess, to that problem be to share the formula and do more localized production in places that have ordered the vaccine? Is that a way to effectively ramp up production in a meaningful way to sort of accelerate all of these vaccine programs around the world?
Yes, that's a reasonable approach, but of course not everywhere has the scaled up cell culture facilities. You know, these are sterile facilities that require to grow mammalian cells, tissue culture as it's called, in very large volumes, in very safe conditions.
Professor Ian Jones at the University of Reading, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Don't forget, all our vaccines coverage lives under the Fast Track tab at marketplace.org. In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.